Of course, we've already introduced all of our speakers, and notably our conference administrator, a title that I was able to help build up. But Father Benedict has been, well, around ever since I was. He was one of the priests when I was here in second grade. So he's going to go over some notable anniversaries this year, both good and bad, inform you maybe of things that you, or review some things you've already known, and inform you of things you don't know. Please welcome to the lectern for this afternoon's conference, Father Benedict Hughes.
First of all, just one note before we begin. As Father said, there are these pieces of paper on the tables. And after this lecture, we'll have about a 10-minute break to set up here for the question and answer session. So during that time, you'll have a chance to bring up the questions or give them to a priest. But feel free to write questions that have come to your mind about any topic during this talk, if you wish. Now, I am sure you are all inquisitive, wondering what on earth the cryptic title means notable anniversaries. And I would say that this is a continuation of the theme last year, or one of the themes. We had several talks last year on Vatican II because 2012 was the 50th anniversary of the beginning of Vatican Council II. And especially for the younger generations who hear the word all the time, Vatican II, but really don't know what it was or what that word means, the purpose last year of those talks on that topic were to explain what Vatican II was and why it is erroneous and must be rejected. But this past December, December 20th to be exact, Benedict XVI signed a decree declaring that Paul VI had practiced all the virtues in an eminent degree, therefore awarding him the title Venerable and paving the way for his beatification. I think my jaw hit the floor, because if there is one man whom you would blame for the destruction of Catholicism that we've seen over the last 40 to 50 years, it would be Montini, Paul VI. So this year is the 50th anniversary of his election in 1963, in June of 1963. And again, because those probably younger than the age of 50 have no recollection of Paul VI, I wanted to talk a little bit about him, what he did, who he was, and the harm that he brought to the faith and to the faithful. But before doing so, I thought we should have at least a mention of a good anniversary before the depressing one. And so it should be mentioned that we are celebrating this year the 1700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan. Now, around 305, thereabouts, the two emperors of the Roman Empire, co-emperors, were Diocletian and Maximian. And they came up with a plan to divide the government of the Roman Empire among four persons, what's called a tetrarchy. And those four persons were Constantius, Severus, Galerius, and Maxentius. In 306, Constantius died. He was a general in Gaul, or Germany, that area. And his soldiers declared his son, Constantine, to be emperor in his place, a member of the tetrarchy. Well, this tetrarchy gradually dissolved to the point that there were two left, and they were Constantine, who is now in history called Constantine the Great, and also Licinius. But Maxentius was still around, and he was the son of Maximian. Nobody really liked him. He was not really a capable administrator. But he was opposing Constantine. So Constantine marched on Rome with his army, and on the evening of October 27th, 312, Constantine had a vision. Now, he was not a Christian, although his mother was a very devout Christian, St. Helena. But Constantine had a vision of the cross in the sky, and around it the words, "In hoc signo vinces," "In this sign you shall conquer." So he had his soldiers go into battle the next morning on the day of October 28th, 312, with the sign of the cross. And they won an improbable victory, a complete victory against the army of Maxentius, who was slain in that battle. And so Constantine then became the emperor. One of the first things he did just a few months later was to meet in Milan in early 313 with his co-emperor, who was Licinius, and they published what is called the Edict of Milan. We sometimes see it reported as the Edict of Toleration in history books. This brought about such a shift in history that it is referred to by historians as the peace of the church, the triumph of the church, or the Constantinian shift. If you were to look it up, to Google Constantinian shift, it would tell you all about the Edict of Milan and what it did. First of all, it granted freedom for Christians to practice their faith publicly. It ended the persecution of the church. Constantine himself donated some of his palaces to the church that were turned into basilicas, churches. He, at his own expense, built a number of churches in Rome and patronized the church. Also, this edict outlawed crucifixion as a form of punishment for criminals. A few years later, I think it was in 321, Constantine declared Sunday to be a holiday and all markets were to be closed. And so he really brought the practice of Christianity into the common way of life in the Roman Empire. Constantine himself did not become a Catholic, in other words, was not baptized until his deathbed in 337. And sadly, he was baptized, certainly validly, but by an Arian bishop. And that is the one stain on his life, on his administration as emperor, is that he went to live in what became known as Constantinople. He had this city built, Constantinople in the east, and that's where he lived. It was Constantine who called for the Council of Nicaea, which condemned Arianism in 325. In fact, he even paid for the traveling expenses of those bishops who couldn't afford to come so that all of these bishops would gather together. And that was the first general council of the church, not counting the Council of the Apostles in Jerusalem, as related in the Acts of the Apostles. So the Council of Nicaea in 325 was brought about by Constantine. He was influenced by Arians towards the end of his life, and he began to waffle between the decrees of the Council of Nicaea and then the teachings of Arianism. But at any rate, his Edict of Toleration in 313 was a monumental shift in history, allowing the Catholic faith now to thrive and to propagate and have churches and so forth. So that's a good anniversary we celebrate this year. Now, I mentioned that Paul VI, whose baptismal name was Giovanni Battista Montini, John the Baptist Montini, was born in 1897 and was ordained in around 1920 or 1921. He went then for further studies in Rome after his ordination and was assigned to the Secretariat of State. And in that position, he gradually rose up the ranks of diplomacy in the church. He worked in the Secretariat of State from 1922 until 1954, about 32 years. Now, this brings up an interesting point, and it really bothers me when I hear traditional Catholics saying this, blaming Pope Pius XII or Pope Pius XI or whoever? How did they allow Montini to rise to such a point? And why wasn't he excommunicated, etc.? It's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback and to look back and say, this pope should have done this or that pope should have done that. Most people are aware of the fact that Montini was exiled by Pope Pius XII to Milan and made the Archbishop of Milan. Now, he had risen to such a point of prominence in the Vatican that this was a demotion. It was even referred to as the Siberia of Montini. So he was sent there, made an archbishop, and it was always the case that the Bishop of Milan was automatically made a cardinal within a very short time. There are certain sees in which the bishop, whoever was nominated to be bishop of that city, of that see, would become a cardinal in short order. That never happened for Montini during the remaining 4 or 5 years of Pope Pius XII's life. So that was a real slap in the face to one who had been trusted in the Vatican. So what happened? Well, there's an interesting book by Brother Michael of the Holy Trinity called The Whole Truth About Fatima. And part three of that book is all about the third secret and giving the details of how it was sent to the Vatican and all of this and a lot of tremendous amount of detail. But in that book, the story is told about how Pope Pius XII was informed in 1954 that his pro-secretary of state, Giovanni Battista Montini, had been collaborating with the communists. And there was very damning evidence of this given to the Pope by an ambassador from one of the countries in Europe. And it was incontrovertible evidence. And this is what led Montini to send, led Pope Pius XII to send Montini out of the Vatican. Now, there's an old Latin saying, promoveatur ut amoveatur. And you have to understand that in Rome there are certain customs and practices, and the church has always sought to prevent greater harm from scandal coming. So here was this scandal of what Pope Pius XII found out about Montini and his collaboration with communist Russia. And I don't remember all the details, but it was something to do with the Vatican had a secret organization or operation, a seminary, for men who wanted to be priests, who would study, be ordained secretly, and then be sent into Soviet Russia to try to reach the faithful there and be sent as like their workers or whatever, or traders, and then try and revive the faith and help the faithful to persevere in Russia. And somehow, the communists kept finding out every single one. Every single one would go to Russia, and in no time, he would be arrested. And all this came back to Montini. So, promoveatur ut amoveatur means let him be promoted so that he can be removed, so that he can be eliminated. And again, you have to understand, and again, people today say, well, why didn't Pope Pius XII just excommunicate him? Again, very easy for us to say in hindsight, but Pope Pius XII had the greater good of the church to be concerned about. Interestingly, those who remember this, those older than I, remember that Pope Pius XII was gravely ill, for about a year, even more than a year, I think. All of 1954, I believe, very few public appearances, and then just got well around January of 1955. And I wonder if this information that came to him was the cause of his grave illness. At any rate, I want to go back and take a little bit of a view of the false popes that we have seen over the last 50 plus years since the death of Pope Pius XII in 1958. So we have John the 23rd, Angelo Roncalli. Now he had been the Cardinal Archbishop of Venice. He had also been before that a a nuncio to Paris, and he was considered to be a very genial type of person. And it's interesting that one of the things that has come to light after the life of John the 23rd and Paul the 6th is that there were actually some votes for Montini in the conclave of 1958. Now, he wasn't even a cardinal at that time. So he, you know, be very, very rare. It hadn't happened for hundreds of years that a non-cardinal would be elected by the cardinals in conclave. But that there were even some votes for Montini shows how much there were certain elements that wanted him to be the next pope. Montini was very influential. As I said, he rose in the ranks, and he got to the point where he and another priest, a Monsignor last named Tardini, those two basically operated under the direction of Pope Pius XII, the Secretariat of State. Now, the Papal Secretary of State is the second most powerful man in the Catholic Church, traditionally, in Rome. Pope Pius XII, Secretary of State, was Cardinal Maglione. Now, Cardinal Maglione died in 1944, and it's very interesting that Pope Pius XII did not appoint a replacement. So for the next 14 years until his own death, Pope Pius XII was not only Pope, he was also, in fact, the Secretary of State. He wouldn't appoint, and Montini seemed to be the next one in line. There were many who liked Montini a lot, who followed him. They knew of his progressive ideas, and they were called Montinians. Very much idolized him. But he kept all this hidden. One of the things, we wonder, how could this all have happened? The modernists knew how to conceal their real views about things. Now, Montini's father had been editor of a communist newspaper in Italy at one time. John the 23rd, Roncalli, had in his personal file in Rome, it said, suspected of modernism on his file. So these were things that were known, but of course, after Pope Pius XII died, he had no control of what the conclave would do. So John the 23rd was elected in 1958, October of 58. Very interestingly, Father Espina was talking about Bergoglio, studying Italian a few months before he was elected. John the 23rd was elected in 1958 and pulled out of his pocket a pre-prepared speech to give to the cardinals accepting his election. Isn't that interesting? Now, within 3 weeks of being elected, he nominated his first group of cardinals. The top of the list was Giovanni Battista Montini, the Archbishop of Milan. So Montini became a cardinal right away and immediately began to have a lot of influence. When Vatican II began in 1962, John the 23rd, Roncalli, invited Montini to come and live in the Vatican in his own papal apartments, the only cardinal that did so. And he was very influential in the council. Now, the council, the first session was October to December of 1962. And then there was going to be a recess until the following autumn. Well, during that time, John the 23rd died in June of 1963. And the conclave that met a few weeks later elected Montini. Montini then controlled the chair of Peter for 15 years. And in that time, did an incalculable amount of harm that it's hard to believe that one man could have done so much. And one really wonders how he could not have been completely complicit in intentionally trying to destroy the faith and destroy the church. And I'll get to that a little bit later. But the death of Montini on August 6, 1978 was one of those events for me that I will always remember where I was when I was told the news. Because as a seminarian at the time, we thought, you know, there's going to be nothing left when he's gone. And the fact that he finally died, and now he's standing before God to render an account of all the things that he did, just took my breath away, just was shocking to me at the time. So So that was in 1978, and then the conclave elected one who became known as the Smiling Pope, Albino Luciani. And Time magazine called him the September Pope, because 33 days later he was dead. Now, there have been some, and I've debated some would-be traditional Catholics who try to defend him and say, oh, he must have been intending to bring everything back. That's why they got rid of him. Well, how then do you explain his choice of name, John Paul? Never in the history of the church had a pope been named with two names. Of course, it's John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. And not only that, when the cardinal dean or whichever Camerlengo, whichever one asks the candidate who's chosen what name he will be known by, he said, John Paul the 1st. Now, there's no such thing as a first until there's a second. And it was as though he was saying, there's going to be another one after me named John Paul. That's what it would seem to indicate. It was very unusual that he would say John Paul, first of all, two names, but then the first. Now, he was the first one, the first supposed pope, never to be crowned a pope, because Montini, Paul VI, had eliminated the right of coronation of a pope. So he was simply installed as the Bishop of Rome or as the pope. Why did he have such a short reign? Many of you may have read the interesting book by David Yollop called In God's Name, which advances different theories why he may have been assassinated. I think it's almost certain that he was assassinated, but a lot of the evidence seems to point to the Vatican Bank. And there's the theory that he had on his desk and was going to publicize it any day a replacement, a lot of officials in the Vatican Bank, and they didn't like that, and that's why they got rid of him. But be that as it may, the point I wanted to make is that he was not in any sense of the term a traditionalist. He did not have any intention of bringing things back to the traditional faith. So he lasted 33 days, and then the next conclave elected, of course, Wojtyla from Poland, Karol Wojtyla, who took the name John Paul II, and had an extraordinarily long reign of pretended pope, possession of the chair of Peter, for about 26 and a half years. And of course, he died in April, Parkinson's disease of 2005. Then the cardinals elected Joseph Ratzinger, who of course is still alive, and resigned in February of this past year when Bergoglio was elected. Now, of all those men, I want to pick out three that I would attach a certain understanding or a name to them. First of all, John the 23rd. How would he go down in history to the Catholics, the traditional Catholics for sure? He was a visionary. He's the one who came up with the idea of Vatican II, and in fact called for Vatican II, even though none of the cardinals, bishops were requesting it. It took them totally by surprise. So he had this vision. We have to open the windows, let some fresh air in the church. He certainly was a modernist. It has even been said that the FBI have papers in his file, in the FBI, that the secret police in France saw him going once a week to a lodge in Paris, dressed in lay clothes, going to a Freemasonic lodge. The fact of the matter is, you know, so much of that is hard to prove. The fact of the matter is that he totally promoted modernism. Somebody asked him after he was elected what he would be like as Pope. And he said, think of what Pope Pius XII would do, and I will be doing the opposite. So that is what he said about himself. And to me, that says a lot. But it seemed to be, he was only there, he was 77, I believe, when he was elected, and was only there for 4.5 years. It seemed as though his whole purpose was to get Montini, make him a cardinal, paving the way for his election. Montini was the one that they, meaning Freemasons, wanted in charge. And Montini, as I said, destroyed everything. Montini signed every single one of the decrees of Vatican II, not John the 23rd, Montini. He promulgated Vatican II. He brought it to conclusion. He enforced it. He brought us the Novus Ordo Missae, the new Mass. He revised every one of the seven sacraments. He eliminated virtually abstinence on Friday, the idea of penance, fasting. We have all of the sacrileges of the guitar masses and all of that kind of thing came in with Paul VI, communion in the hand. The list is seemingly endless of what he did in 15 years. And then some will try and defend him by saying, oh, look at what he said. He said towards the end of his life, he said, the smoke of Satan has entered the church. Well, yeah, you opened the door and, you know, and brushed it in. And as though that's somehow going to exonerate all of the wicked things he did, I don't believe that that was any kind of a lament. He still had time to change things and never did. Montini was buried in a plain wooden casket, and there are pictures of it lying there on the pavement in St. Peter's Piazza without a crucifix on the casket. And then it was buried in the earth, and it's spooky to go into the tombs under St. Peter's Basilica where they have all of the popes, or those that are buried there. And you see the marble sarcophagus, inside of which is the casket of Pope Pius XII or Pope Pius XI, etc. And then you come to Montini's, and it's down in the ground. And he had it in his last will. I want to be buried in the earth. Did not want to be buried as other popes and bishops are. There's an interesting book on him written by a priest who passed away, I think, just within the last year or last 2 years. Father Luigi Villa, an Italian priest who was in his 90s when he died, dedicated his entire life to exposing the Freemasonic infiltration into the Vatican, into the church. And he wrote a book called Paul VI Beatified? Never. And the gist of the book is there's no way that a true pope could ever beatify this man. But it seems as though, it would not surprise me at all, that we could hear any time that he will be beatified. Again, he was already declared by Benedict XVI venerable, which just boggles the mind with all that he did. And by the way, that book I mentioned is promoted by Our Lady of Good Success Apostolate. They're out of Wisconsin, in case anyone wants to get a copy. But you can get a free download. And I will give you the email address, the website address, where you can just read the whole thing online if you wish. It's got a lot of pictures, and I've just skimmed through it. I haven't had time to read it, but it looks very interesting. Okay, let's go into then a little bit more of, I'm kind of jumping around to the material I had here, a little more on Paul VI. He was born in 1897, as I said. He worked in the Vatican Secretariat of State for over 30 years, 1922 to 1954, and had a position of trust under Pope Pius XII, and then that changed completely. He was sent to Milan. And again, Brother Michael of the Holy Trinity's book, he was a French religious brother. I don't know if he's still alive, but his book on Fatima, very thick book in three parts, has the complete explanation of what happened there and why he was exiled from the Vatican. I mentioned some of these, but I want to go through. I just simply wrote a list of what I would call the quote-unquote accomplishments of Paul VI. What did he do? What is he responsible for? So this is a partial list. As I said, he signed and promulgated every single one of the decrees of Vatican II. He visited frequently with communists and never condemned communism. In fact, during Vatican II, a petition was sent to him signed by 200 bishops asking for the condemnation of communism at Vatican II, and he never even answered the petition, just ignored it. He gave away his papal tiara to the United States, gave his papal ring and pastoral staff to the United Nations. He began the custom of carrying the hideous pastoral staff with a broken cross and the modern art, hideous image of Christ on the cross that you see these modern popes holding. And Benedict XVI, who who brought out, for some occasions, a traditional staff, nevertheless also used this hideous, broken cross, modern pastoral staff begun by Paul VI. Paul VI visited the United Nations, first praying in the Freemasonic UN meditation room. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but in the United Nations building in New York City, there is what's called a meditation room. And the entire room is filled with occult symbolism and satanic symbolism. So he went to the UN General Assembly. He first of all prayed in the UN meditation room, and then he went into the General Assembly and declared that the United Nations is the last hope of mankind. He wore the Jewish breastplate and ephod that was worn by the high priests in the Old Testament on a number of occasions. For instance, he wore it in New York City when he had Mass in Yankee Stadium. Very odd, a pope wearing the ephod worn by the high priest in the Old Testament. He appointed numerous cardinals, what we might say stacking the deck. He wanted to eliminate any possibility that a traditional cardinal would be elected after him. So first of all, he completely blew the ceiling off the number of cardinals, which used to be at 70. It would never exceed 70. It was like that for hundreds and hundreds of years. Under Paul VI, it went to over 100 cardinals. He also excluded cardinals 80 years of age or above from participating in a conclave. That was a studied effort to get rid of, to eliminate any influence of Cardinal Ottaviani and the other hardliners who still existed in the Roman Curia. He wanted to make sure that his reforms would not in any way be reversed. He traveled internationally promoting ecumenism. He met with Jewish, Orthodox, and Protestant leaders. He refused to condemn communism. He eliminated the oath against modernism. Pope St. Pius X required that every seminarian upon his ordination to the major orders would take the oath against modernism. Every professor in a Catholic university, and especially in a seminary, would take the oath against modernism. That was eliminated, I think, in 1967, but eliminated by Paul VI. He also eliminated the Index of Forbidden Books. He promulgated, of course, the Novus Ordo Missae. Now, this is something that really bothered me in 2007. Father mentioned Summorum Pontificum. When Benedict XVI promulgated this decree, Summorum Pontificum, this motu proprio, saying that now any priest could say the Latin Mass of 62 without even needing to get permission from his bishop. When Benedict XVI promulgated that, he stated, and I don't know how he could do this with a straight face, he said, after all, the Tridentine Mass was never outlawed. It absolutely was outlawed. Many of us know traditional priests who were persecuted because they didn't want to say the Novus Ordo. It was absolutely mandated in 1969. It became obligatory in this country in 1970. And that was, of course, Paul VI. He revised the rites of administration for every single one of the seven sacraments. He set a retirement age for bishops, and again excluded older cardinals from participating in conclaves. He permitted nuns to no longer wear the habit, changed the discipline of the church on fasting and abstinence, virtually eliminating the whole concept of penance. He allowed new psychological grounds for granting annulments. In other words, he allowed the idea, well, I wasn't ready to get married, I didn't know what I was getting into, etc., etc., to the point that now all one needs to do, who wants an annulment, someone who's married in the church, wants an annulment from the modern church, all they have to do is fill out a form and put down their money and wait. And sure enough, in a month or two, they'll get their annulment. What happened as a result of Paul VI allowing new psychological grounds for annulments? The number of annulments skyrocketed to scandalously, so much so that Protestants look at us and say, well, the Catholic Church, How come you don't allow divorce? You have annulments and it's the same thing. It is in the Novus Ordo Church, just with a different name. So he took a process that was in place in the Catholic Church and completely changed it and kept the name annulment. And all it is divorce and remarriage. He was primarily an ecumenist and a humanist. Paul VI had a penchant for using the term modern man. He loved that term, and he always talked about man, the cult of man. Let me give you a few of the quotes in this regard. Well, this one is on religious liberty. She, referring to the church, has also affirmed during her long history, at the cost of oppression and persecution, freedom for everyone to profess his own religion. No one, she says, is to be restrained from acting. No one is to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his own belief. As we said, the council demanded a true and public religious freedom. That was an address in 1969. And of course, that was enshrined in the decree of religious liberty at Vatican II that he signed. Here is an interesting quote when he welcomed the Dalai Lama into the Vatican and a group of Buddhists. He said, "We are happy to welcome your holiness today. You come to us from Asia, the cradle of ancient religions and human traditions, which are rightly held in deep veneration." So he referred to the Dalai Lama as your holiness. Here he is now on man. Just a couple of quotes. "Are you looking for God? You will find God in man." Another one. "We, more than anyone else, have the cult of man." That was his closing discourse to Vatican II in 1965. Another quotation, this one from a general audience in 1972, "Man is master of himself. He is free, who is the cause of himself." The cause of himself. So very, very humanistic and very naturalistic. In fact, he was an avid follower of the space exploration, very interested in it. And when the United States space program reached a particular milestone, he said, in glowing terms, he said, "Man is king of the earth, and now he is prince of the heavens." So just a very, very humanistic terminology, the cult of man, that we see throughout the speeches of Paul VI. And as I mentioned, he chose to be buried in the earth. I wanted to give you another quote that I like. This is from the book by the twins, the first book they wrote, What Has Happened to the Catholic Church. Paul VI meeting Helder Camara, who was an archbishop from Brazil in the 60s and 70s, very, very communist. Father Casimir was talking about liberation theology. He was the paragon of liberation theology. So Paul VI meeting Camara said, "Good morning, my communist bishop. How are you?" And Camara replied, "And good morning to you, my communist pope." Interesting. So, I come to the question, was Paul VI intentionally trying to destroy the faith? I don't see how one could come to any other conclusion. How could anyone think that someone who had a doctorate, well-trained, well-educated, just did these things being misguided? It would be difficult to see how there could be any other verdict. Paul VI, again, had his few little traditional things. People will point to Humanae Vitae. Now, Humanae Vitae came out, I think, in 1969, and it was a declaration, I think an apostolic constitution, declaring, condemning the pill, condemning artificial contraception. And so again, people saying, see, he's true pope, etc. And these few reiterations of what already was church teaching do not in any way exonerate this man. But what happened? It was very interesting. There was an absolute rebellion on the part of theologians, bishops, and especially priests and lay people, saying, we don't care what the Pope says, we don't agree and we're not going to do it. So here he had created the groundwork for rebellion, self-will, determine your own thing, situation, ethics, etc. And now he claims to be the victim when they don't accept this teaching. Very interesting story. I think I mentioned it at a past conference, but a group of American theologians took out a full-page ad in the New York Times and other newspapers as well the next day. So they had already written this up. They knew it was going to happen, that Humanae Vitae was going to be published. They knew what was in it. They had this all prepared. It was signed by something like 100 theologians in this country declaring open rebellion. We will not submit to this teaching. We don't agree with it. We won't submit to it. Well, where does that spirit of rebellion come from? It comes from Vatican II. And Paul VI is the one who gave the world Vatican II. So he is entirely responsible for that type of attitude, that type of reaction. Again, as I mentioned, he made some statements like the smoke of Satan has entered the church, as though he's doing what he can to try and keep it from happening. And he's the poor victim. And it's just modern society that is so bad that that's why all these evils are creeping in, these moral evils are creeping in among Catholics. It's because of society. Well, is it any coincidence that the breakdown of public morality began in the 60s during Vatican II? Of course not. And the destruction of the Mass. You know, speaking of Vatican II, I found it very interesting. I read an article in June of this year, and it was a Vatican watcher, a journalist who covers the Vatican. And the article came out towards the end of June, and it was a commentary on the first 100 days of Francis Bergoglio as supposed pope. And one of the interesting things that caught my attention in this article was that he never mentions Vatican II. Now, since then, he has. But why would that be? Why would Bergoglio, for the first 100 days of his pontificate, never refer to Vatican II? Well, the reason, as Father Espina said, is because he's a child of Vatican II. There's not a question of trying to defend it. It's fact. And it's just reality. It's a done deal, as the saying goes. So he didn't feel any need to try and defend it. It's just what it is. In fact, it's as though he hardly remembers pre-Vatican II days, although he did ridicule the idea of a spiritual bouquet and say that I remember that back, you know, in my youth. So yeah, he remembers what it was like before, but he is in every way a child of Vatican II. Very different from Benedict XVI. Benedict XVI was a pathetic figure, constantly trying to defend Vatican II. And you might remember the last address to the clergy of Rome on the part of Benedict XVI was an off-the-cuff, very unusual for him, walking among these clergy in the Paul VI audience hall in the Vatican, the clergy of the city of Rome, talking about Vatican II. And, of course, he was one of the architects, Ratzinger. Benedict XVI was one of the periti, one of the theologians. I might mention, at Vatican II with a shirt and tie on, as a priest, a 30-year-old priest or so, at Vatican II, a theologian, an expert. And so he felt the need to constantly defend it. So what was his final excuse to the priests assembled the day or 2 days or so before he resigned? The media did it. The media gave Vatican II a wrong interpretation. We got to get back to the real interpretation of Vatican II. It was tragic to see how this man couldn't admit the facts before everybody's face, that Vatican II changed, destroyed the faith of millions. So, very much a contrast with Bergoglio, who hardly talks about Vatican II because to him that's just so far back and it's just reality. It doesn't feel a need to defend it like Benedict XVI did. What are some of the results of the pontificate, the 15 years of Paul VI, from June of 1963 until his own death 15 years later, 1978. I just put down a few, and I don't have numbers, which would make this even more astounding. Number one, a tremendous loss of vocations. Priests leaving the priesthood, nuns leaving the convents. In some cases, literally entire congregations of religious dissolved because all the members or nearly all of them left, and they had these empty buildings and they were absorbed by another, the few that remained absorbed by another congregation. But the number of priests that left the priesthood within, say, 5 years of the conclusion of Vatican II was astounding and, of course, terribly scandalous. Mount St. Michael closed down in 1969 or 1970. And all of these buildings that in the reign of Pope Pius XII were bulging at the seams with vocations in a very, very short time were emptied as a result of the policies and the teachings and the initiatives of Paul VI. So that is at his doorstep. Young people no longer knew their faith. Each of us has a story. You could tell a story of where Vatican II really hit home to you. And for me, the year was 1967. And there were three interesting events in that year. One of them was that the nuns came back from their summer at the mother house, and all but one had this much shortened habit. And the one, God bless her, the Mother Superior, still had the full religious habit. So that was in the summer in our convent there of 1967. But also, in our catechism class that fall, we had new catechisms that were a joke. That most of the page was just this picture, which was hard to tell what it was in modern art of our Lord or the apostles or whatever. And then there would be a one sentence underneath about, you know, this very nebulous stuff about charity and love and joy and all that kind of thing. No comparison to the Baltimore Catechism. So this is something that happened during the reign of Paul VI, is all these new catechisms and the elimination of the Baltimore Catechism and the young people no longer learning their faith, to the point that in a generation, you have Catholics, supposed Catholics, you could walk up and talk to, and they might use some of the terms we do, but their concept of doctrines of the faith is just totally different from ours. And that is due to Paul VI, new catechisms. The liturgy became entirely man-centered, an utter loss of reverence. Communion in the hand, communion standing, no longer kneeling in the church, the guitars, the bongo drums, all of that came in during the reign of Paul VI with his approval, and the sacredness of the liturgy was completely lost, and again, it became a very man-centered celebration. Communion in the hand, I mentioned, a spirit of rebellion and private judgment of morality. Do you remember all of the marriage encounters and the values clarification sessions and all of those things? That was during the time of Paul VI. That was a big thing. And I was in a seminary, and it was interesting because almost every weekend there, there'd be some group that would come in to use the classrooms to have their values clarification sessions and their marriage encounters, etc. All of this was subjecting Catholic morality to private judgment. Situation ethics, everything became relative. That term relativism has now been enshrined. And if they don't use the term, they practice it. And that has been a result of Paul VI and of Vatican II and this new tone for the church. Now, I want to conclude by giving you a few quotes, and my title for these quotes is The Revolution Continues. And they are going to be quotes of Bergoglio, quote, Pope, unquote, Francis. As you know, he likes to speak off the cuff. And I can, some of these quotes are so bizarre and so outrageous, I can just picture cardinals in the background just cringing and pulling their hair and trying to think, okay, how are we going to spin this one? Because that's what happens. After he gives a talk, there will be the spin, just like, you know, how the politicians always have their spin meisters who come out and try and tell you what he really said and try and put a good face on it. So that's what they do with Bergoglio, with Francis, because his statements are so outrageous. So this revolution that was started by John the 23rd, that was really begun and completed, really, in full force by Paul the 6th, and then was cemented in place without any possibility of going back, insofar as the normal person in the pew, by John Paul II, and I'll have more to say about him tomorrow night. But John Paul II, who was there for almost 27 years, 26 and a half years, traveled all over the world continuously promoting this new religion. So he certainly has done that, and now we have the product of Vatican II, the Vatican II Revolution. So the revolution continues. Listen to these quotes, and I think that they are so apparent, and the absolutely anti-Catholic meaning of these quotes, that no commentary from me is necessary. These are a few of my favorites, if I should even use that term, the ones that jump out at me as being just so bizarre. Quote, "Everyone has his own idea of good and evil, and must choose to follow the good and fight evil as he conceives them. That would be enough to make the world a better place." Can you just see? I know I said I wasn't going to comment on him, but I got to say this. I have to say this. Can you just see a jihadist beheading a priest in Syria doing good as he conceives it? So what you have here is there's no reference to an ultimate objective morality or an objective good or evil. See, this is part of the Vatican II revolution. There's no objective morality and there's no objective truth. Everything is relative. So there they are, these jihadists, killing nuns and priests and burning down churches, etc. And they're doing good as they conceive it. It's my second choice. This is very recent. You probably heard this one. Quote, "Proselytism is solemn nonsense. It makes no sense." Unquote. Try and tell that to the apostles, to all the martyrs, the missionaries down through the ages. They wasted their time. Number three, and this to me is the most shocking. Quote, "The most serious evils that afflict the world in these days are youth unemployment and the loneliness of the old." Not abortion, not, you know, rampant materialism, pornography, you can name any other evil. The unemployment of the youth and the loneliness of the elderly. Those are the greatest evils in the world that we must fight against. This man is not in any way, shape, or form a Catholic, a member of the Catholic Church. How then could he or his predecessors who are part of this revolution and fostered it and promoted it, how on earth could they be ahead of a church of which they're not even members? Thank you.